Production. Recorded live.
Hi, Susan Newman, a.k.a. Susie Brandtastic, your host for today's broadcast. The CEO and green brand visibility designer at Susan Newman Design Incorporated, specializing in innovative branding and design for entrepreneurs, environmental organizations, and creatives. Today's show is sponsored by Frogs Are Green, spreading awareness and engaging people around the world to help save frogs and amphibians. The 5th annual Kids Art Contest and the 6th annual Photo Contest are currently accepting entries. The deadline is December 15th. To learn more about the Frogs Are Green cause, just visit frogsaregreen.org. And now I'm so pleased to introduce my guest for today, Robin Moore. So let me tell you a little bit about Robin. He is a conservationist, photographer, and the author of In Search of Lost Frogs. Since gaining a PhD in biodiversity conservation, Robin has been a powerful voice for amphibian conservation. He is a conservation officer with Rainforest Trust, Global Wildlife Conservation, and the Amphibian Survival Alliance, the largest global partnership for amphibian conservation. He is a proud senior fellow of the International League of Conservation Photographers, represented by National Geographic Creative, and recently co-founded Frame of Mind, an initiative that empowers youth around the world to connect with their natural and cultural worlds through photography and visual. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you for the kind introduction.
My pleasure. So we're going to jump right in, and I should have said leap right in, right? So why don't you tell me a little bit about your history and when you first started sort of researching and photographing frogs and why?
Okay. Well, my history started when I was as young as I can remember, really, when I would my interest with amphibians really began. I grew up in Scotland, where I would spend my summers in the highlands of the northwest, and there I would go out searching for frogs and newts. And that childhood fascination really developed into a desire to understand them. And I went on and I did a PhD in biodiversity conservation, focusing on frogs, and then I started off down the route of research in a postdoc before really deciding that I wanted to be more involved in conservation. So almost a decade ago, I guess, I joined Conservation International, where I was for 7 years working with the amphibian program, and that really gave me the opportunity to be involved in supporting amphibian projects on the ground, but also in communicating both amphibian conservation programs and trying to get people engaged and involved in amphibian conservation.
So would you say that you're more on the research side but like to take pictures, or more on the photography side but like to know what's behind it?
Yeah, it's. I think I don't get to do much research at all these days. My photography, I've always been interested in art and in photography. But right after I joined Conservation International, I took a trip to Haiti. And I decided before I went to bite the bullet and invest in a digital SLR camera, something I'd wanted for the longest time. And they were just sort of becoming affordable, I guess. And that really sort of opened up a world of opportunity for me. I didn't know much about digital photography. I didn't know what shooting in RAW meant. You know, I was very, very naive. But I took a lot of photos, and I came back, and I really sort of realized that the power of photos in helping to communicate what we were doing on the ground, helping to show what I was seeing. And I put together a photo story of my Haiti experience, and actually won the annual photo contest that year at Conservation International. And, you know, I thought, oh, maybe there's something here. I also got introduced to Christina Mittermeier, who was the founder of the International League of Conservation Photographers. And she was extremely encouraging. And, you know, I started to get involved in that world of people using their photography for conservation. So for me, I realized it was this very powerful tool for actually telling our messages. You know, right before I started at Conservation International, the first ever assessment of amphibians had been conducted, and it showed that a third were threatened with extinction. So one of my sort of early, I guess, challenges was trying to get people to care that a third of amphibians were threatened with extinction. Right. And what I realized from, you know, simply hitting people over the head with those statistics, it doesn't always work, you know. If people don't care for amphibians in the first place, they're not going to care that they're disappearing. And I realized that, you know, we needed to be courting people to getting them interested, getting them involved. And through photography and through stories, we were much more likely to be able to do that than simply guilting people into caring.
Right. Well, that's like, you know, when they put up on, you know, different websites, like, you know, these 10 threatened with extinction, or, you know, showcasing new discoveries, people, you know, go wild for that. But I, you know, and it gets a lot of play, but like you said, I think that the public is still confused on, you know, how this really affects them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, yeah, people love new discoveries. They love to know that the world is still full of surprises, that there is a wild world out there. But, yeah, definitely the challenge is drawing the connection with their everyday lives, you know, how the loss of these animals and these ecosystems is actually going to impact their everyday lives.
You know, recently I was watching Bill Maher, his program, I think it was last week, and he said a statistic that I thought was unbelievable, and I'm hoping I'm getting it right, but he said something like 50% of the wildlife on the planet has disappeared in the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was a study WWF published, yeah, that showed that. I think it was just over 50%, yeah.
Isn't that, I mean, how could people not understand that this is affecting them?
I know, I think it's, you know, it's, statistics have this way of sometimes just being too abstract. You know, when we talk about amphibians declining, for instance, it doesn't matter if you're telling people that 20 or 200 or 2,000 species have gone extinct. It elicits the same response in some ways. It's not really eliciting sort of an emotional response, I guess. And I think, you know, that's where flagship species can come in. You know, the pandas, the polar bears are obviously icons of conservation. They elicit an emotional response in people. You know, when you see a polar bear hugging a block of ice, that I think elicits that response. And part of our challenge is when we're trying to convey the crisis of a whole class of animals or vast numbers of animals, it's not really appealing to the emotional part of our brain. So I think, you know, the challenge is getting people to actually have that emotional response. And I think for me, amphibians do have an opportunity for that, because so many people have childhood memories of going out fishing for tadpoles, collecting frogs, and not many people have that personal relationship with a panda or a polar bear. You know, if I had kept a polar bear in my closet, maybe I would have gone into, you know, mammal conservation. But my relationship was with amphibians. I developed that early personal affinity, and I think because so many people have that, that's an opportunity to sort of rekindle that early connection, with nature. And you know, one of the reasons I care is because, you know, I have a 2.5-year-old son, and I realize that this is the world that I'm passing on to him. You know, I want him to have these same opportunities. I want the world to be an equally rich and wonderful place that's full of the capacity to amaze. And and I think for me, preserving the biodiversity is a huge part of that.
Right. So tell me about In Search of Lost Frogs.
So In Search of Lost Frogs is my new book, and it's basically about a campaign that I spearheaded while I was at Conservation International. It was really an attempt to try and take the story of the loss and decline of amphibians and tell it in a way that was going to engage people rather than turn them off, because I felt like we had spent so much energy and time and effort trying to get the message out that the amphibians were declining and going extinct, that people were becoming immune to it. They were, you know, jaded by it. And so around 2003 in Costa Rica, there was a frog, a variable harlequin frog, that was thought to have gone extinct, that reappeared after years of being presumed extinct. And it sort of raised questions about, you know, what can this frog, what can this survivor tell us? You know, it was thought to have succumbed to this pandemic fungal disease that swept across the world,
right,
killing amphibians. And it wasn't a long case. Over the next few years, more frogs in Australia and elsewhere in Central and South America started to reappear. So I started to wonder, you know, maybe this is an opportunity to tell a different story, that shows sort of a glimmer of hope, that uses these rediscoveries as a hook to get people engaged and involved. So I started pulling together a list of species that hadn't been seen in at least 10 years, but most of them between about 15 and 160 years previously. And I was actually amazed how many species had not been seen, you know, in that long. Within a few months, I had a list of 100 species, and I put together a top 10, because people love top 10s. And I put together a little wanted poster of these 10. And, you know, it was a fairly subjective exercise, the top 10. I wanted to pick the poster children, you know, the most iconic, the most photogenic, the most interesting of the species. And that poster seemed to capture people's attention. Within a couple of months, we got support for more than 30 teams in over 20 countries to go in search of these lost species. And so it had the makings of a communications campaign. It got the attention of the communications team at Conservation International. And over the course of 6 months, you know, we had these teams going out looking for lost species, and we had blogs from the field. We had updates on what they were and weren't finding. And I actually also got to go on a couple of these trips. You know, I couldn't sit on the sidelines and let all the others have all the fun. So I got to go to Colombia to look for a toad that hadn't been seen in 100 years. And I got to go to Haiti, Costa Rica, and also to Israel. And that was 2010, actually. It launched 4 years ago. And I think although the campaign ran for 6 months, it generated enough attention and enough momentum that idea really lived beyond that. And so it was about, I guess, 2 years ago that I was approached with the idea of writing a book about it. Hadn't really crossed my mind, but when I started really thinking about it, I thought, well, there's a good story here. you know, I'd obviously been on a lot of these expeditions and brought back a lot of photos. So the material was all there. And then I spent a year writing. Actually, turned out to be a lot more work than I could have ever imagined. But I think, you know, it was worth it. And the book was released last month and it's sort of the culmination of all that. It's a you know, 70,000 word narrative with, I think, over 400 photos from the expeditions.
Wow. So what happens when they find a frog that you haven't seen in so long? Do you record it and measure it and photograph it, and you know, and is it one singular frog, or are there like many out there?
Yeah, it really varies. So, I mean, I'll give a couple of examples. One of the most interesting Lazarus frogs was in Israel. There was a frog called a hula-painted frog that disappeared in the 1950s when its wetland home was drained. The Hula Lake was completely drained, and with it went a unique ecosystem and many of the species that lived there. And the hula-painted frog became a symbol of extinction. It was actually the first amphibian ever to be declared extinct in the 1990s, and it was one of our top 10 lost frogs. Now, it actually turned up in 2011 after 55 years without being seen. Nobody quite knows where it had been, but it suddenly went from this symbol of extinction to a symbol of hope.
Right.
The wetland had been reflooded, and you know, it's sort of a symbol that if you give nature a chance, it can come back. And they you know, after they found one, they went back and they looked for more, and they found about a dozen individuals, and they're now monitoring them, you know, to see what status the population is, whether it's increasing, whether it's stable, and it's within a nature reserve, so they're also taking the steps needed to make sure it persists. Now, other ones such as the variable Harlequin frog in Costa Rica, they've found now two populations. Both, you know, are relatively small, not many individuals. And what you often find is that after the disease has swept through and you have survivors, they seem to be persisting at fairly low numbers. And again, we're not really sure why, and we're not sure, you know, how we can assist them to recover, but these are very active areas of research. So in most of these cases, the local university or researchers will start to study the animals to try to understand, you know, first of all, what it was maybe that set these ones apart from the ones that died around them, and second of all, to see how we can help them to recover and reestablish and hopefully prevent similar, you know, extinction events in the future.
So I'd like to hear more about the Frame of Mind project. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so one of the places I've mentioned is Haiti. It was one of the first places I went with Conservation International, and it's somewhere I've returned over and over again. I've been there close to a dozen times. And it's you know, it's a very challenging place to do conservation. It's really you know, the relationship between people and the environment is really, it's sort of on that edge. I mean, the environment is heavily degraded, and people in these rural areas are really feeling the impacts of that. And you have these last sort of fragments of forest that are still there, that still provide sort of a last chance. And I've been sort of interested in this, how we engage the local people in conservation. You know, obviously rediscovering these frogs, it gets picked up by the international media, but when you go into these local areas, it doesn't have much resonance for the people there. And you can't go, obviously, go in and say, you know, save your frogs when you're going to bed hungry every night. And, you know, one of the things I realized was, you know, as in elsewhere around the world, a disconnect between the people and environment. I had the opportunity when I was growing up to, you know, foster a relationship with nature through the amphibians. But what I was finding that people didn't have that same relationship. And, you know, I was going in, I was photographing, I was coming out, I was telling my story. But I started to wonder what would happen if I actually empowered the people to tell their own story in a way that is more relevant to them and their daily lives. So I bought 20 digital SLRs, not SLRs, digital point-and-shoot cameras, and I teamed up with a local partner called Panos Caribbean that was working with young journalists. I mean, they were training young journalists. These are kids aged between 11 and 18. And we decided to start to focus on conservation messages and use photography to try and empower the kids to tell their stories. So we spent a total of 2 weeks with the first group talking about biodiversity, about conservation, about where their fresh water comes from, about where their food comes from. And then we taught them how to use the cameras. We taught them how to tell stories. We did storyboarding. And we then got them to get into groups, to pick a theme that was relevant to them, and then really explore that from a personal perspective. So, you know, the themes would be something like fresh water. So really explore where their fresh water comes from. And after 2 weeks, we returned. 6 months later, we had an exhibit in the local town library of their photos and their stories. We produced a book that we handed out to all the kids, and we had a book launch. And it was really, first of all, a very powerful way of connecting the kids with their nature, you know, their natural environment. And I think the relationship that I established with them, you know, helped open their eyes, open my eyes to like a very different way of seeing. And I think the stories and the photos that they produced were a very powerful conduit for getting the message to their peers, to their parents. And one of the kids, a girl called Lovely, she was 12 years old. We took them to meet the regional minister of the environment, and Lovely stood up and challenged him and said, "What is your reforestation policy for the national park, you know, supplying our fresh water?" And everyone was gobsmacked. I think nobody more than him. And it was just a very different way of, you know, getting the message about conservation, the importance of conservation for the future of these kids out there, and to sort of to challenge, you know, the decision makers on what they were going to do.
So does this project like live on as like, you know, it's going to travel to other places, or is it something that is going to be reoccurring here each year?
That's a good question. It's, you know, it's a model that we would love to explore. We've now done 3 workshops in Haiti. We went back and did another one with 3 of the original kids actually as teachers. So they were training the new kids. And it's something I would love to explore. It's one of these things that's it's difficult to scale up just because it's very, very hands-on, and, you know, you really need to invest a lot and work with the kids over a period of time. And as with most of these things, obviously it depends on getting support. You know, we had to, the first couple were very much a labor of love. You know, I bought the cameras, but we'd really like to make it sort of financially self-sustainable and get support for more workshops, both in Haiti and beyond. I think there's so many different places where this model could be very effective in engaging youth. And, you know, really, it boils down to partnerships also. We, you know, I formed good relationships with groups in Haiti, and that, you know, one thing leads to another. You know, having been down there 6, 7, 8 times, it became a natural progression that I would go back there and That's you know, the main reason why we've now done three in Haiti, but I think it would be fantastic to export it elsewhere.
And do you see it progressing beyond just photography into art or theater or even film?
We've discussed, you know, many different angles. We actually have had two filmmakers come with us in two of the workshops, and they've made short films about the program. We thought about bringing in film, but we're also wary of spreading it too thin. You know, it's very to really get the kids thinking about telling a story, and you don't want to you don't want them to be thinking about too many different technical ways of doing it. So by focusing on photography, you know, they have one means of telling the story to really focus on.
Right.
After they've told the stories, we also get them to write the captions to tell the story. But, you know, we have discussed other things such as bringing in poetry, bringing in other forms of writing, bringing in art. And I think there's huge value in tapping into all these different means of expression. You know, I think some of the kids maybe would express themselves better in a different art form. And I think it would be fantastic to explore that. But, you know, so far we've focused on the photography and the visual storytelling just because it's made sense to really hone in on that and do that well. You know, I think we wanted to produce this book that we're hoping actually to get into school curricula in Haiti as a way of, you know, many of the schools don't have an environmental education curriculum. So we thought, you know, having the kids tell the story of their environment could be a good way of getting that across to other kids in schools across Haiti. So that's something we're looking into now.
Fantastic. So can you share a couple of your methods when you capture those amazing images of frogs?
So the actual methods, photography methods.
Do you have secrets to time of day or lighting or, you know, anything that photographers out there might fascinate you?
Well, the timing is always pretty much dictated by the subjects, by the frogs themselves. So I almost always have to go during the rainy seasons. So in Haiti, I normally try and go around, you know, the rainy season, which is also the hurricane season. So it poses a lot of logistical challenges. I'm glued to the weather channel the week leading up to the trips just to make sure there's no hurricanes on the way. And actually, our first Frame of Mind workshop, we had a hurricane that stopped us getting into the park. And we had to return 6 months later to actually take them into the park because they were bitterly disappointed, and they'd all gone out and bought new shoes for the park. And so we had to promise to come back and take them in. So hurricanes are always a risk. So I normally, you know, time my trips for when it's best for frogs, but probably worst for photography. You know, it's the rain and the humidity is murder on photographic gear. And most of the frogs that we find are active at night. So one thing I've really learned to do is to control the light using using flashes. And on my first trip to Haiti, I had no idea what I was doing, but I since learned how to use the camera. The flash is off camera, so I'll have one or two flashes that I'll use off of the camera. So I'll have one attached to a cable, another one that's triggered like a slave, and I'll use a softbox or some sort of softener. I think one of the most important things when photographing frogs, because they have moist skin, It's getting the lighting right, because it's very easy to get that glare, you know, to get the light reflecting from the skin. So getting the camera and the flash, or getting the flash to come, you know, from the side with a diffuser to soften it, and it makes the light sort of wrap around the frog, and it just makes it look much more even light. And when I'm photographing at night, you know, I'm relying on artificial light, so I'm completely controlling the light. So I'll have everything in manual mode, and that also means you can, you know, you can experiment. And with digital now, I think the learning curve can be so steep, because you see in an instant what you're getting, and you can modify. You know, you can tweak the flash a little more, put up a little more power. You can increase the shutter speed. You can do all sorts of things to change the exposure. And during the day, I also, because I'm working in the forest understory where it's dim light or it's very high contrast, I'll also normally use flash either as the only light source or to augment the natural light. And I think, you know, it really helps to bring out the textures and the colors of the frogs when you're using flash, because it really sort of it makes them pop. And I think that, for me, was the biggest sort of turning point when I really learned how to use flash properly. Because I always, when I started photographing, I thought, you know, flash was the devil and you should never use flash and everything should be natural light. But, you know, when I started actually using flash properly, I realized that it really brought out my subjects so much more, and gave me so much more creative freedom. You know, I could go out and photograph frogs at night when I was finding them, you know, just using the flash rather than having to wait till the morning and finding the right conditions. So for me, it's, you know, that kind of close-up work is very different from maybe other photography, you know, landscape or photography, when you're really at the sort of mercy of the conditions and the when you would really want to wait for the early morning light or the evening light, so the magic hour when the light is soft and beautiful. You know, when you're photographing these small subjects, you can control that to some extent.
Right. So do you have a favorite frog?
It depends what day you ask me on. I think I have many favorite frogs. One of my favorites, actually, you know, from writing the book, the variable harlequin frog, I did so much research and read so much about that. It sort of, that one grew to mythical status in my head. It sort of became this iconic creature and beautiful. The harlequin frogs are so beautiful. They have very slender, long limbs, very sort of gangly, but they look very regal. And they come in colors from yellows to, you know, oranges to reds, mottled with black. So they're very, very beautiful frogs, and they're also very fragile. They're the hardest hit by this fungus. And the variable harlequin frog, the one that came back in Costa Rica, just to me became this iconic creature. And I actually, as I was writing the book, I realized that, you know, my book wasn't complete without me actually going to try and find and photograph this frog. So I think it's, you know, the last expedition I do for the book was actually going to Costa Rica to find the variable harlequin frog. So right now that's my favorite frog, because it's just such a beautiful and enigmatic creature. And it was actually so hard to find out where and how I could go and find it, because everybody's so secretive about its location. And, you know, it's natural that, you know, we don't want collectors, obviously, to know where they are, or, you know, it could be the death knell for the species. So it was actually very difficult to arrange to go and see. So that only added to my desire, I guess, to see this creature.
And so tell me about Amphibian Survival Alliance and what they're doing.
Yeah, so the Amphibian Survival Alliance is, it's now the world's largest partnership for amphibian conservation. It's I guess the idea is for it to be kind of the bird life of amphibian conservation. You know, there aren't many global bodies that are really tackling the conservation of amphibians on the scale that is needed. And the concept behind the alliance is that it's an alliance of partners who are all in some way contributing to the conservation of amphibians. So some of the partners are groups that are focused on other taxa. You know, they may be, you know, focused on birds. But what you often find is that those areas that are very important for birds are also important for amphibians. So if you go to Colombia, you know, some of the most important areas for birds are these small tracts of forest that also harbor frogs that are found nowhere else or are threatened. So the idea is that rather than, you know, everybody working in their own silos and duplicating efforts to try and really leverage the capacity of all these different groups to really scale up amphibian conservation and to address the main threats. And really the main threats, immediate threats, I guess, to the survival of amphibians are disease, the amphibian chytrid fungus, and also habitat loss. 9 out of 10 threatened amphibians are impacted by habitat loss. So it's not as dramatic as some of the other threats, but it's, you know, it's really a very serious issue. And one of the approaches of the Amphibian Survival Alliance is to try and target and protect those most critical habitats for amphibians and other species.
All right. How can people support what you're doing? You know, it's important for them to realize that a lot of the stuff that you do, like this education program, you give away for free. So what can they do, people out there do to help support your efforts?
Yeah, no, that's for the Amphibian Survival Alliance, the website's really designed to try and engage people and give people different ways of either supporting financially, which obviously is always needed, the resources are scarce, but also giving people material to help spread the message, which is also really important. So if people hop over to amphibians.org, they will be able to find out more about how they can become involved in amphibian conservation. And then if people want to find out more about Frame of Mind or the Lost Frogs, that information is all on my website, which is robindemoor.com, and I think I have links to Frame of Mind and also to the Lost Frogs page in my website. And the Frame of Mind, again, has different ways in which people can become involved. The most urgent need, I guess, for Frame of Mind is just support for these workshops. But, you know, welcome contact and input from anyone who wants to be involved.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being on the call today, and thanks to all the guests who tuned in. I suppose if you have any questions, just contact robindemoor.com, and we're all going to do whatever we can to help.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
My pleasure. All right, signing off. Thanks so much. Talk to you
soon.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.